Well, if you've got a Bible with you this morning, I want to encourage you to open it to Genesis chapter 25. Now, we've been in the book of Acts for a long time. We are doing something different for our spring and summer series. And what we are doing is we are sort of beginning a brand new series today. And I say sort of because in actual fact, as a church, we have studied the first half of the book of Genesis before. Many of you wouldn't have even been here at this time, but back in 2018, we did do a series on the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis that we called In the Beginning, and we explored lots of the foundational stuff that we find in this great book. In 2020, we did a series called Between Promise and Fulfillment, and in that series, we looked really at the life of Abraham as we find it in Genesis 12 all the way up to Genesis chapter 25. Now, that's 2020, so that is 4 years ago. It has been a minute, as they say, since we've been in this book, but we are coming back to Genesis now, and we're going to spend the next couple of months exploring the story of Jacob as we find it in Genesis 25 to Genesis 36. The plan next summer then would be to come back to this book and look at the life of Joseph as we find it in the end of Genesis. Anyway, that just sort of sets you up for where we are and where we're going to be these next couple of months. But I entitled this series, Straight Lines with Crooked Sticks. And the reason for that title is because this is the account of Jacob's life. And as we study his life, as we look at it, we will see that it is a demonstration of the grace of God. That grace is seen in the way that God is able to draw straight lines with crooked sticks. Jacob is a crooked stick. He is a schemer. He's a hustler. He's a deceiver. He is the kind of guy, if you sort of want a mental picture of what Jacob is like, he is the kind of guy who comes into the revolving door after you, but somehow comes out ahead of you. Right? That's Jacob. He's always working an angle, always looking out for his own interests, how he can get ahead. You're going to see as we make our way through this section that he's also a polygamist. He's a coward at times. And from his first appearance in the pages of the Bible, he is primarily concerned with his own interests. But, and this is a big but, he is also a man chosen by God and transformed by his grace. God draws straight lines with crooked sticks. Now, this doesn't mean just do whatever you want, live however you please, because, you know, there's grace. But I do think that this section of Genesis is here to teach us something. And I think there's at least two things that we ought to understand by the end of the time that we spend in these chapters. The first one is that none of our lives can actually be described as a straight line. You know, while we might desire to live a life that can be described as a long obedience in the same direction, all of us we'll find that our lives are filled with fits and starts. We stumble. We take wrong turns. We get sidetracked. We get stuck. That's all of us. And for my money, The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan is still the best book for helping us understand what the Christian life actually looks like. If you're familiar with that story, The Pilgrim's Progress is actually an extended allegory. The protagonist of the story is a young man named Christian, or at least he's renamed Christian, and he's trying to make his way to the celestial city. He's trying to get to heaven. Along the way, he encounters lots of obstacles. Some of those obstacles come from the outside, and some of them come because of his own foolishness. And there is a reason that that book is one of the best-selling books of all time. It's never gone out of print. It's been translated into more than 200 languages. And if you're looking for something to read this summer, I would just suggest get an updated copy of The Pilgrim's Progress and read it, and you will be able to relate to lots of the obstacles that he encounters along the way. So one thing this part of Genesis helps us understand is the crooked path or crooked road that we follow. But the other thing it helps us understand is the transforming power of God's grace. So not to go all spoiler alert on you, but the Jacob we meet at the end of the story is very different from the Jacob we meet at the beginning of the story. And what happens to bring about that transformation is that he has an encounter with God. And after that encounter with God, all of the scheming, all of the striving, the self-importance, all of that is dropped. And the very closing scene of Jacob's life, as we find it in the Bible, is a scene of him worshiping the Lord. So we're sort of parachuting into this, and I would just say I think we all need that word of grace. So let's dive into it. We're looking at Genesis 25, verses 19 to 34, and this is what it says. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger." When the days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out all red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of the red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau the bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Well, as I said, we're kind of jumping in here, and it might seem like we're jumping in halfway through a book and halfway through a chapter. So let me just sort of remind you, this story takes place within the larger context of the book of Genesis, really within the larger story of God's redemption of mankind that we find cover to cover in the Bible. This story in particular actually covers a lot of years, and I think there's a lot for us to learn from what we read here. So I'm going to walk you through it under three main headings or three things that we learn about. And the first thing we learn about is God's surprising ways. And we can see this in multiple ways throughout this passage. So let me just highlight three of the surprises that we encounter in these verses. The first surprise is related to size. Now, our passage begins with these words. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. And if you want to know how the book of Genesis is structured, it's actually found in that phrase. These are the generations of, or this is the account of. So we meet it for the very first time all the way back in the creation account where it says this, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." And what follows those words is the creation account. Here's what's going to happen now. Sometimes we meet this phrase at the beginning of a genealogy, like in Genesis chapter 5, where it says in Genesis 5, this is the book of the generations of Adam. And then what follows that is a list of all the descendants of Adam. We see it again in chapter 11, and here we see that this phrase often signals a new chapter in Israel's history. In chapter 11, it says, "Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram." And what follows that is the account of Abram, or Abraham, and his life. And that account runs all the way from chapter 11 up to chapter 25, where we find these words, "These are the generations of Isaac." And when it says these are the generations of Isaac, what it's actually going to tell us is the story of Jacob, his son. You actually find it again in chapter 37, where it says these are the generations of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old. And what follows that is the account of Joseph's life. So that's how the book is structured. And we're kind of right in the middle of it. But what does any of that have to do with size? I mean, what does it mean to say that one of God's surprising ways is in regard to size? Well, one of the patterns you begin to see as you read the Bible is that God seems to have a penchant for working with or beginning with something very small. So our passage continues like this in verses 20 and 21. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, the key phrase there is where it says she was barren. Now, if you think about that, that note or that theme is actually a theme that marked the entire Abraham story. Their childlessness. At the very beginning of that story, we had a similar note about Abraham or Abram. It says in chapter 11, verse 30, now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Now, if you know the Abraham story, you know that in chapter 12, God is going to appear to him. He's going to make this all these promises to him. He's going to tell Abraham, you are going to become a great nation. Your descendants are going to be so numerous. They're going to be like the stars of the sky. You won't even be able to count them. And if you know that story, then you know that that tension between God's promise and the fulfillment of that promise is what fueled the entire Abraham story. All the way from Genesis 12 to chapter 21 when they finally gave birth to Isaac. Now this chapter picks up that story 40 years later, and in lots of ways nothing has changed. It's still just one patriarch with a barren wife. It doesn't seem like we are any closer to seeing the promise of this great nation with so many descendants being fulfilled. Now, you might remember that in the Abraham story, at one point, they were struggling with their inability to conceive. So they came up with an alternate plan. They just sort of wanted to help God out a little bit. In Genesis 16, it says, now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant, that it may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So Abram took Sarai's advice, and that union did produce a child. That child's name was Ishmael. But God made it clear he was not the son of the promise. This was not the fulfillment of that promise. But when you look at the comparison between the son of promise, Isaac, and the other son, Ishmael, there's a stark contrast, and it's right here in this chapter. Just back up a little bit in chapter 25, and notice what it says in verses 12 and following. It says, these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, named in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, Abdiel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Massa, Hadad, Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedema. I count 12 sons there. Ishmael's line has fertility coming out of the yin-yang, right? I mean, everywhere there's children being produced. But Isaac and Rebekah can't seem to have a child. And God so often does things this way. He often starts with smallness, with something or someone of no consequence. And this is the way of God's dealing with his people. You might remember the parable that Jesus told about the kingdom of heaven. We read this. He put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds. But when it is grown, it is larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." It starts out very small, and it grows into something beyond our wildest expectations. That is how God works with his people. That's how he works with the church. I mean, we've been doing a study of the book of Acts, and the book of Acts tells us about the birth and the growth of the early church. And you might remember the very first note we get about the church back in chapter 1. It tells us that there were 120 people in all. That was the number of believers before the day of Pentecost. And that grew like crazy. God often begins with something very small, and yet that something small grows into something much bigger than we ever would have imagined. Yeah, this note about the church from the Belgic Confession back in the 1500s is a good summation. It says, "This church has existed from the beginning of the world and will be to the end. For Christ is an eternal king who cannot be without subjects. The Holy Church is preserved by God against the fury of the whole world. Although for a while it may look very small and as extinct in the eyes of man." It's actually what we see in the offspring of Abraham and Isaac and those who follow. It often looks so small, and yet it grows into something so huge. So we often see God's surprising ways with regard to size, but we also see it with regard to timing. Look again at verse 20 and 21. Right, verse 20 tells us, "And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean." So he's 40 years old when he gets married. Verse 21 goes on to say, "And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah his wife conceived." Now, if all we had was verse 21, we might say, well, that seemed easy. She's barren, he prays, she gets pregnant, that's it. But actually, take a look at verse 26. Because it says this, "Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel." So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So Isaac was 40 years old when he got married. He was 60 years old when the twins were born. Now, I only went to public school, but in my maths, that's 20 years, right? The children came after 20 years of marriage and 20 years of praying. Now, if 40 seems like late to be starting a family, I mean, what does 60 feel like? Last week, Sean led us in a study of the kind of rest that we find in Jesus. And I suspect that one of the reasons many of us find it hard to enter into that rest is because we're always in such a hurry. Right, we want things instantly. I know I'm always in a hurry. Like, I become impatient just driving behind a slow driver. Like, I just out of my way. I just want results. Even if I have no, you know, fixed time that I need to be somewhere, I'm just always in a hurry. God is never in a hurry. And God does not operate on our timetable. I found these comments from Dale Ralph Davis to be helpful. He says, "The unhurriedness of God seems strange and unwelcome to us. The passage of time with no noticeable moves toward promise fulfillment poses a problem for faith. We prefer a deity with high blood pressure who is on the move, whose promises are delivered with microwavable instructions." Right? I mean, isn't that us? Right? We want stuff now. We want God to answer now. And I've probably told you this before, but I prayed for my mom for more than 30 years that she would soften her heart. It took more than 30 years before she finally did that. So God's ways are surprising in the size and sometimes in the timing. And the third surprise about the ways of God is related to his choice. Verses 22 and 23 say this. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." Now, there's a lot of foreshadowing, a lot of history that gets wrapped up in what God says to Rebekah here. But the most surprising thing comes right on the final few words. The older will serve the younger. Now, maybe that's not totally surprising to you. Like, I'm the youngest in the family. And sometimes it does work out that way. Like, the youngest gets all the privileges, and I understand that. But you have to know, at the time, societal norms were that the firstborn son had a special place in the family. He's the one who would get a larger share of the family inheritance. This was known as the law of primogeniture. But if you read through the book of Genesis, you will find that almost every story involving siblings reverses that order. It's not the firstborn who offers the occupies the place of preference. So God's favor rests on Abel, not Cain, Isaac, not Ishmael, Jacob, not Esau. And that trend continues in regard to Rachel, not Leah, Zerah, not Perez, Joseph, not Reuben, and Ephraim, not Manasseh. So what are we supposed to conclude from that? Right? That God doesn't like firstborns? And you say, I knew it. Hate being the firstborn. I think what we're supposed to learn is that God is not bound by human conventions and that his choosing is a mystery. Listen to the way the Apostle Paul later reflected on this account. Here's what he said. "And not only so, but also when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of him who calls, she was told the older will serve the younger." Now, the question to ask is not so much, well, why did God choose Jacob over Esau? I think the question we all ought to ask is, why does God choose any of us? The answer is a mystery. So we learn firstly about the surprising ways of God. The second thing we learn about here is a family's flawed faith. At the outset of the series, I think it's important just to point out that no one really comes out looking like a hero. There is faith here, but as is true in all of our lives, it is a flawed faith. Now, you can see that Isaac has faith. I've already mentioned it, but verse 21 tells us that Isaac prayed for his wife, and the word that's used for prayer there is intercessory prayer, right? So he's active in prayer. In fact, he prays for her for 20 years. So Isaac maintains his faith in God's promise even when he sees no evidence of that promise coming to pass. But Isaac's faith is not without flaws. Verses 27 and 28 fast forward to what happened when the twins grew up. And here's what it says. "When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob." Now, the truth is, Isaac and Rebekah both played favorites. Isaac's favoritism seemed to stem from the fact of what Esau could do for him, right? He was a man's man. He's a hunter. He provided game, and he liked to eat that game. Jacob, it says, stayed close to the tents. He was more of a mama's boy, and so Rebekah loved him. But this whole theme of favoritism is going to be a perpetual problem in the household of Isaac. And as we move on in the story, we're going to see other flaws in Isaac's faith. Like in the very next chapter, you're going to see how he repeated the exact same mistake or deception that Abraham had done. He's going to come into a place and he's going to say of his wife, "No, she's my sister," just like his dad did. His reason for doing that was fear for his own safety. Even though he already had the promise of God's protection. So Isaac had faith, but his faith had flaws. And Rebecca's faith is on display here too. She gets pregnant. She gets to that point that we might call quickening, right? She can feel movement within her. She doesn't yet know she's carrying twins. And then verse 22 says, the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is thus, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, her question in the Hebrew is almost incoherent. We could literally translate it, why this I? That's what she utters, why this I? Which you can see how they get to, why is this happening to me? But nevertheless, she knows exactly where to turn with those kind of questions, right? It says, so she went to inquire of the Lord. That's the response of faith. So Rebecca has faith. She's in trouble. She goes to inquire of the Lord. But just like Isaac, Rebecca played favorites. And in chapter 27, she's going to show herself to be a kind of master manipulator, right? She's going to come up with this elaborate scheme so that Jacob can trick his father. You know, dress in these clothes, dress in his clothes, put this fur on, I'll make a special meal, and we can deceive him. Now, maybe she's just trying to bring about this prophecy that's given about the older serving the younger. But if we learn anything from this entire story that runs from Genesis 25 to 35, it is that God brings about the fulfillment of his promises, not because of human involvement, but in spite of it. Right? God is not like the proverbial little old lady that needs help across the street. So Rebecca had faith, but it was a flawed faith. Now, we're going to come to Esau in a couple of minutes, but what about Jacob? I mean, he's the protagonist of this story, but he's not the hero. You know, Isaac and Rebecca were not great at naming babies, so you might not want to take your cues from them. The first one comes out, and he's super hairy, so they name him Harry. Jacob comes out, he's hanging on to his brother's heel, and they name him a name that is a play on words. The Hebrew word for heel is Achav, and the name Jacob is Yaakov, which literally you could translate it as something like one who grasps or grabs the heel, or heel grabber. A person who's always seeking to get ahead. And Jacob lives up to, or more accurately, lives down to his name. Esau will later say this about his brother. He'll say, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. So Jacob was a hustler. He was also a bit of a huckster. And almost every one of his dealings in these chapters involves some kind of deception. He deceives his brother. He deceives his father. He deceives his father-in-law. He often doesn't seem like a model of faith. But again, the closing scene of his life is a scene of worship. So the flawed faith of Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob is an important thing, I think, to highlight in our day. It's a reminder. The Bible presents its characters warts and all. There's no sort of whitewashing who they were. Now, we live in a day when people want to cancel all sorts of people from the past because, you know, their practices don't measure up to our contemporary values, right? So there's some skeleton in their closet. There's some sin in their past. Obviously, they have nothing to contribute to us today. I think that's a huge mistake. As we go through these chapters, we're going to see we learn a lot from their faith and from their flaws. Listen to these words about Jacob from Chad Bird. Jacob seems to be anything but a model disciple. He's a trickster, liar, and selfishly ambitious. A man who fathers children with four women and leads a dysfunctional family rife with jealousy and backstabbing. But Jacob is also Israel, the namesake of the Old Testament community of God, chosen and blessed. As such, this sinner saint who limps along with the Lord, burdened by weakness and beset by problems, is the mirror image of all of us who follow Jesus. In his life, we see our lives, our struggles, our failures, and most especially, the God who loves us and chooses us as his own. The hero of this story is not Jacob. The hero of this story is God. See, Jacob is a crooked stick. And God draws lines with crooked sticks. And the truth is, every one of us in this room is a crooked stick. And what we need is an encounter with the living God and transformation by the grace of God. So we learn about the surprising ways of God. We learn about a family's flawed faith. And thirdly, we learn about one man's tragic choice. And this is where we come to Esau. Now, I didn't put him in the category of the rest of the family with flawed faith because from all descriptions, Esau didn't seem to have any faith at all. Esau was a man driven by his passions. The story right at the end of the chapter illustrates that. Verse 29 and 30 say this. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." So Esau is put in a full day's work. He's tired. He's hungry. Jacob is cooking up some stew. Literally some red stuff. That's what he actually says. Give me some of that red stuff. Esau wants it. And he not only wants it, he wants it right away. And he wants it so bad that he is willing to sell his birthright for it. Now, the birthright, again, meant several things. It meant that you would receive a double share of the family inheritance. It meant that you would assume the headship of the family when the father died. In this particular case, it meant that you would be the recipient of all that was promised to Abraham and to Isaac. Esau thinks about that. Actually, he doesn't think about that. He just says, just give me some of the red stuff. Take my birthright. I'll trade all of this for that. Now, this wasn't even pizza or a burger, right? This is lentil stew. I suspect most of us see Esau as a bit of a sympathetic figure. Yeah, I mean, he lacks self-control. But Jacob is the schemer. I mean, he's clearly taking advantage of his brother in a weakened state. But the Bible's perspective on Esau is decidedly negative. You know, we often refer to Hebrews chapter 11 as sort of like the hall of faith, right? These are all the people who have gone before us and accomplished great things by their faith. You know, that all through that chapter, there's that refrain, you know, by faith Noah, or by faith Abraham, or by faith Moses, and then a list of what they accomplished by faith. And the emphasis in that chapter is really on how we ought to emulate the lives of those who have gone before us. That's Hebrews 11. On the heels of that, in Hebrews chapter 12, we get a word about Esau. And listen to what it says there. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. See to it that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. Now, there's a lot we could say about Esau. We can see that he was a man who was driven by his passions. He's controlled by his desires. We could borrow Paul's language from the New Testament and say that his God was his stomach. Now, here it's related to food, but as we continue in the story, we're going to see that he's driven, he's controlled by his emotions. Later in chapter 7, we'll read this. Now, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Right? I just have to vent my full passions. That's Esau. And I think it's worth reflecting on the spiritual implications of this for all of us. We live in a day when following your desires is seen as the highest good, right? Self-expression, self-fulfillment. Denying yourself anything, food, sex, money, that's seen as oppressive. I mean, doesn't God just want you to be happy? And isn't the real path to happiness just doing whatever pleases you? What kind of God would limit the pleasure of his creatures? I stumbled upon a clip of John Lennox. John Lennox is a Christian apologist from Australia. The part I stumbled upon was a Q&A part of a debate with a prominent atheist, and the moderator of the debate posed this question to him. He said, "Why would you choose to worship a creator God who forbade man to eat from the tree of knowledge? One which you have obviously eaten from because you're a rather knowledgeable man. Why would you choose to worship this sort of deity who would have kept you down?" And John Lennox answered that question by saying this. He said, "That's a very good question. I'll tell you why it's a very good question. I noticed it was asked originally by a snake. The answer to your question, though, is this. Do I worship a God who wants to keep me down? I'll tell you the kind of God I worship. I worship the kind of God who made me in his image, encoded himself into humanity, came into our world to provide a basis through his death and resurrection that I could become something that I was not by creation, and that is a son of God. The notion that God is trying to keep us down is actually the original lie." And he's right. And Esau falls for that lie. See, what we see in Esau is not just the desire for immediate gratification, though that's often a problem. What we see in Esau is the trading of that which is of eternal value for that which is temporal. You know, as I read this, at least, Esau sounds a little bit like a teenager to me. Listen again to verses 31 and 32. "Jacob said, 'Sell me your birthright now.' Esau said, 'I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?'" Now, I'm not picking on teenagers when I say that. It's just that sometimes in your teen years, everything seems like it's a life and death issue, right? Like you're going to die all the time. "You're not going to let me get a cell phone? I'm going to die. All my friends have it. You're not going to let me hang out with my friends on Friday night? I'm going to die. Everyone's there. You're not going to die, okay?" Now, some people never grow out of that. Notice how the narrator sums up this episode in verse 34. Like, this is the conclusion. "Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright." He despised his birthright. Remember, the writer of Hebrews said, "Don't be unholy like Esau." And that word "unholy" is a word that we could translate as profane. But the idea behind it is really secular. Right? Living life without God, no concern for his promises. Esau's only horizon was the here and now. Now, maybe that doesn't seem like a big deal to you, but many people will miss out on the kingdom of heaven because their only horizon is what they can see and what they can taste and what they can experience and what they can accumulate now. So let me close with a parable that Jesus told about the kingdom of heaven. "But he said to him, 'A man once gave a great banquet and invited many. And at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is now ready." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'I have bought a field and I must go out and see it. Please have me excused.' And another said, 'I've bought five yoke of oxen and I go to examine them. Please have me excused.' And another said, I've married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So the servant came and reported these things to his master. Then the master of the house became angry and said to his servant, go out quickly to the streets and lanes of the city and bring in the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. Now notice those who are missing out on the kingdom of God. It wasn't, you know, they were engaged in debauchery, wild living. No, they were just taken up with earthly pursuits, right? Oh, I bought some oxen. I bought a property. I got married. I don't have time for that right now. And so the writer of Hebrews tells us, see to it that no one misses the grace of God. And often the greatest threat to that is simply a preoccupation with this world and all it has to offer. So let's pray. And Father, I pray today that there would be no one here who would miss out on the grace of God. No one who would exchange the offer of salvation for something temporal, some temporal pleasure, some temporal thing, some temporal relationship. God, we thank you for this story. We thank you for the reminder that though this family had lots of flaws, your grace was evident in their lives. You are able to draw straight lines with crooked sticks. And God, we come to you as crooked sticks. And we ask that you continue to transform us by your grace. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.